Oh, yes, madam. I may be drunk. In fact, shit-faced indeed. But you, madam, are ugly. And tomorrow, in the cold, stinging light of day, I shall no longer be drunk, as painful as that may be. But in the morning, in the cold, stinging light of day, you, my lady, shall still be ugly. Perhaps not a direct quote, but it's chalked up to Winston's fabulous wit all the same. And I bring this quote to you because the lauded High Holy Day, known as Winston Churchill Day, is upon us indeed. So I raise my glass to you in celebration of the immutable, inscrutable British Bulldog of Bastardry himself, Sir Winston Bloody Hell Churchill! Don't mind me if I absolutely butcher, and I mean butcher, the cross-the-pond version of the English language, for 'tis truly the only way to rightly express the majesty of his lordship, Sir Winston, is with an absurd, and I mean absurd, British accent. Rah! Now, to celebrate properly, one must experience and endure breakfast a la Churchill, which, when traditionally observed, as specified in the Holy Scriptures, which were indeed transcribed from the booze-soaked rantings that Winston himself scrawled with a cigar stub, dipped in bean juice like a grotesque yet apt quill in ink, only moments before stroke number 3 and just before stroke number 4, are as follows. Once one awakens in bed, one must, upon no circumstances, set a single little piggy upon the floor until breakfast is consumed in full. One shall then greet the day with a large blast of flatulence that serves the dual purpose of issuing a challenge to God and also heralding one's secretary. Upon hearing the undoubtedly fortuitous anal eruption, the secretary shall then scuttle in toot sweet and serve a lavish tray containing the following. 2 eggs sunny side up, 2 strips Irish bacon, 2 sausage links, 1 hunk blood pudding, 2 fried tomatoes, sautéed mushroom and onions, toast liberally buttered, all of which resting in a ghastly paddle of baked beans. To be consumed with 1 small pot black coffee with sugar and milk, 1 500ml bottle of champagne, 1 Romeo y Julieta cigar, lit, puffed, then chewed to midpoint and chucked, and accompanied with multiple glasses of whiskey. All to be consumed whilst reading the newspaper and muttering, nay, shouting, profane exclamations such as, "That bloody daft troglodyte chamberlain can suck eggs through a goose's arsehole if he thinks he can muster the wit to insult me effectively! Gah!" Then, to cleanse the palate, and spare one's secretary at least some of the certainly robust mouth smell, mouthwash is key. In this case, mouthwash means a glass of British gin with a squeeze of lime to be diluted with club soda as it is sipped. Completing this ritual just once is clearly a Herculean feat of gastrointestinal insanity, and yet, as legend has it, old Winnie is said to have adopted it as his morning constitution, reminding us again that we are but mere mortals before the voracious and godly engine that the man truly was. But all this begs the question, why do it anyway? Why should we honor this man so? Surely it cannot be solely his achievements in gluttony that have engendered such lasting love for the man. And I answer thee, yes, you are correct. For old Winnie was quite more indeed. Now, as I tuck into this sloppy full English a la Winston, fry yourself up some eggs and pour a healthy dram. For today, April the 9th, is Winston Churchill Day. In the year 1874, Winston was born into a ravenously expanding Britain whose new imperial, sword-wheeling tentacles were cleaving into distant nations across the globe. Victoria had just been crowned Empress of India, and the mad scramble for Africa was just kicking off. A direct descendant of the Duke of Marlborough, Winston's daddy was a member of Parliament, and his mum had been born in Brooklyn, New York, making him half American. In school, little Winston was taught a simple gospel. The superior white man was conquering the primitive dark-skinned natives and bringing them the benefits of civilization. And, like every well-bred boy of his era, he yearned for his share of the conquering. Unable to get seated in the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, he managed to grab a spot as a cavalry cadet with the Queen's own 4th Hussars due to familial connections rather than prowess. Hungry to cut his teeth, he again leaned on family influence to get himself posted in a war zone, and charged off to take his part in, quote, "a lot of jolly little wars against barbarous peoples." Young Winnie, which would be a fun young Indiana Jones adjacent sitcom now that I think of it, got himself a posting as an observer of the War for Independence in Cuba, where he got in a few light skirmishes, then tooled around in a few expeditions in Bangalore and Calcutta, then volunteered for combat in India, but was only assigned under the condition that he serve as a military journalist. Thus began Churchill's prolific writing career, an exercise that he also used as a foil against his lifelong depression, which he dubbed his Black Dog. During this period, Winston launched on a self-education campaign, as he called it, diving headlong into Plato and Darwin, sliding into an angsty anti-Christian phase, calling religion nothing more than a, quote, delicious narcotic, and thirsted for logic and reason rather than dogma, a notion which would set him on the path of lifelong agnosticism. Emboldened by positive reviews of his published dispatches and a growing wealth of worldly experience, Winston used his contacts to jump onto General Kitchener's staff and saw combat in the Battle of Omdurman during the Sudan campaign, which became a textbook demonstration of the superiority of a highly disciplined army equipped with modern rifles, machine guns, and artillery over a tribal force of more than twice its size, armed only with older muskets and edged weapons, resulting in a resounding British victory. If you're thinking the 1964 Michael Caine movie Zulu, then you're dead on. And all the while, Churchill was writing stirring battlefield accounts of his fantastical experiences for the Morning Post, even getting a chance to pen a bit of fiction along the way. Yet, during these smoke-choked cinematic battlefields, crackling with Martini Henry rifle volleys aimed at charging, spear-hurling primitives, it was not lost on Winston that their enemies were fighting back because of, quote, the presence of British troops in lands that the local population considered their own, just as Britain would if she were invaded. Even so, Winston tempered these reservations against the, quote, strong Aboriginal propensity to kill. It seems that his overall conclusion was that these uncivilized and dangerous tribes were best under British control. Winston's possession of a moral compass, however warped it might look to modern eyes, did show through when he became vocally critical of Kitchener's more brutal actions during the war, particularly the latter's unmerciful treatment of enemy wounded and the desecration of Muhammad Aman's tomb. Churchill therefore resigned his post, played polo in Bombay, and decided to launch a political career. Though sailing under the flag of conservative, Winnie considered himself a liberal in all but name. Even so, he still couldn't go full hog, as, among many issues, he deplored the Liberal Party's support of home Irish rule and self-governance. Anticipating the Second Boer War, Winston hopped to South Africa, again as a journalist, for the Morning Post and got right into the thick of it. And let it be known that upon setting out, his luggage included over 60 bottles of tip-top shelf booze, a habit he would keep up, calling the USA's prohibition period a, quote, affront to the whole history of mankind. When his train was derailed by enemy artillery, he was captured and interned as a POW in Pretoria. Winnie would later escape from that prison, evading his captors by stowing away aboard freight trains and then hiding in a mine. He then rejoined the army, fought in the siege to retake Pretoria, and was one of the very first Englishmen to trod the newly liberated streets. He even personally demanded and received the surrender of the 52 prison camp guards by whom he had been imprisoned. Some proper Richard Hannay, Mr. Standfast, proto-James Bond adventure novel type lore, that is. After the war, he was again notable for urging generosity and tolerance in victory. With such plumage in his cap, and having received rave reviews for his From London to Ladysmith via Pretoria, in which he vividly recounted his daring exploits, Winston's political career was about to heat up. Just age 25, Winnie wins a narrow victory to take a seat in the House of Commons as a Conservative MP, gaining some serious spotlight with his maiden speech, making it very clear that the boy has got some oratory chops. Yet, although elected as a conservative bannerman, Winston was more and more sliding liberal. The first major proposal put up by his own party that he went against was the Aliens Bill, which was designed to curb Jewish migration into Britain, to which he said that he preferred the, quote, old, tolerant, and generous practice of free entry and asylum, to which his country has so long adhered, and from which it had so greatly gained. Soon consistently voting against his own party, in 1904 he finally did the unthinkable and outright defected, crossing the floor, as they say, and thus went full liberal, which earned him a lot of hate. Also at about this time, Clementine Hozier accepted his marriage proposal, which, having previously unsuccessfully proposed to three other potential wives, made the fourth time the charm for Mr. Churchill. Appointed president of the Board of Trade, Winston pushed forward bills which created the ability to prosecute exploitative employers, established the principle of a minimum wage and the right for workers to have meal breaks, imposed stricter safety standards for coal miners, established labor exchanges through which the unemployed would be assisted in finding unemployment, as well as founding a kind of unemployment insurance scheme, which would be part-time funded by the state, and other lefty social reforms that you might not have expected from someone painted as an anti-socialist. Just to touch on that Churchill quote you may have seen bandied about as a cudgel against modern progressive socialist agendas, the quote goes like this. Socialism is a philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery. Which is actually an amalgamation of two completely separate Churchill passages from 1945 and 1950 respectively, which in fact were very, very specifically said in reference to addressing Britain's dependence on loans and aid from America in the post-World War II rebuilding period. These words had nothing at all to do with domestic social programs, and to use them in such a context is really quite silly. Promoted to Home Secretary, Winston implemented prison reforms that made a distinction between criminal and political prisoners, established libraries in prisons, relaxed solitary confinement rules, did away with automatic imprisonment for the inability to pay fines, pulled back imprisonment for those ages 16 to 21 unless it was the most serious offenses, and even mandated that prisons should have stage entertainment no less than 4 times a year. Though he said he was in favor of women's voting in principle, when he refused to back a bill on women's suffrage unless the electorate, who happened to be all male, found majority support, an unfortunate stance which saw him literally attacked by a suffragist with a whip on the streets of London. He managed to avoid violence with striking Welsh miners. He saw through the siege of Sydney Street, where a pair of Latvian burglars killed several police, leading to a prolonged shootout. Winston came to the scene himself, and when the building they were holed up in caught fire, he stood down the fire brigade, saying that he, quote, thought it better to let the house burn down rather than spend good British lives in rescuing those ferocious rascals. A line that made headlines, as well as made Winston's budding persona as a hard-nosed political pugilist something impossible to ignore. It's fair to say that the British political establishment resented and was rather leery of this fast-rising star, identifying him, even for his own time, to be at the most brutish end of the imperialist spectrum. Bumping up in a big way, Winston was then made First Lord of the Admiralty by Asquith, where he reversed the previous stance against expanding military production. In response to Germany's industrial ramping up of its war machine, old Winston just got gay for the Navy. When mutual de-escalation efforts with the Fritzes stalled out, Winnie famously vowed to build 2 new battleships per every new German one. He invested heavily in technology, kick-starting submarine production, which were brand new at the time, and put focus on the Royal Navy Air Force, even coining the term seaplane, and saw hundreds of the experimental aircrafts built. He also proposed and financed development for what we now know as the tank. When liberals kvetched about his hog-wild spending, Winnie threatened to resign if his proposal for 4 new battleships was not taken off the chopping block. And good thing they didn't call his bluff, because the island nation was very soon going to need every bit of that hardware. ...1914. The Great War pops off. Winnie Winnie transports 120,000 troops to France, sends submarines to the Baltic, and takes full responsibility of Britain's air defense. He promises reinforcements to the besieged city of Antwerp, but when it falls under German hobnail boots just weeks later, Churchill is criticized harshly. Trenches are dug, and the Western Front transitions into a muddy, bloody hellscape stalemate as Britain and France suffer nearly 1 million casualties in the first 4 months of fighting. To which our young rising firebrand quips, quote, "Are there no other alternatives to sending our boys to chew barbed wire in Flanders?" Winston's solution? Open up a second front. Churchill concocts a plan to kick Turkey, the sick man of Europe, square in the dates by striking towards Constantinople via the Dardanelles. Though the War Cabinet eventually does back the risky plan, they refuse to allocate the 50,000 men Winston was asking for. But nevertheless, Churchill sends the fleet anyway. Which brings us to one of our hero's least finest hours. An Anglo-French array of battleships and dreadnoughts rain hell on Turkish defensive batteries in an attempt to blitz the Dardanelles Strait with overwhelming naval strength. Is harder to crack than anticipated. The attack stalls. The Allied admiral suffers a nervous collapse, and Winston, absolutely frothing for them to press on, is forced to replace him. It takes another full month to mount another charge, but this time they go fully for broke, with an 18 battleship strong armada that runs headlong into a bloody floating minefield. French battleship Bouvet goes boom and capsizes in just 2 minutes. HMS Irresistible erupts with a mine strike that cleaves her in half, followed by HMS Inflexible. She too is gutted by an unseen mine and goes under. Amid the carnage, HMS Ocean breaks off in an attempt to rescue her foundering crew and catches an artillery shell that disables her steering, causing her to helplessly plow into yet another mine and is sucked to the bottom of the strait in mere minutes. With losses mounting, the fleet hesitates, and the naval attack is recalled. And yet, despite the fact that any grand beach invasion was predicated on the success of this naval attack, the Allied amphibious assault on Gallipoli goes ahead anyway. And worse, rather than the swift surprise attack carried by the momentum of said naval victory as envisioned, there is instead another full month-long delay, which allows the Turks to turn those beaches into a fortified shooting gallery. Turquoise Aegean is quickly stained blood red as mainly Aussie and NZ-er troops are slaughtered by disciplined and well-dug-in Turkish guns that owned the high ground from Cape Helles to Anzac Cove. Despite the incredible bravery from the Anzacs, the campaign is a complete and utter failure and is abandoned after 8 horrific months and more than 45,000 deaths. Although what occurred is unrecognizable to what Winston had drawn up, blame for the ghastly and pointless massacre fell squarely upon Churchill. And to 20th century eyes, it borders on near absurdity that the attack was even launched. There was no back door to victory, as Churchill had posited. The British Army of 1915 was sorely unready for this scale of an operation, and its success demanded hundreds of guns that did not yet exist, fired by gunners not yet trained, using complex artillery techniques not yet invented, and firing hundreds upon thousands of shells that had not yet been manufactured, used in concert with infantry tactics not yet imagined, much less painfully developed and proven in the heat of battle. Inferior British leadership vastly underestimated the truly well-led and more experienced Turkish troops who were literally defending their homeland, with many Turkish soldiers having family farms and villages just miles away from the front lines, let alone giving proper consideration to the logistical supply chain nightmare involved in giving the Allies any possible chance to win this fight. Churchill, the face of this fantastically failed scheme, is demonized and resigns from government, which is certainly a fate that would doom most men to obscurity. But Winnie is not most men. Rather than end his odyssey there, Winston picks up an Enfield rifle and heads to the Western Front to dodge shrapnel and lead troops as an infantry officer with the Royal Scots Fusiliers. If anything is true in this story, there's absolutely no running from a fight in this chap. But even this muddy and bloody stint doesn't last long. When Lloyd George becomes PM, he appoints Winston Minister of Munitions, where he is able to prove his value, massively upping weapons and munitions productions, negotiating strikes in munitions factories, lobbying for more recognition of soldiers' bravery, and the simple, experience-based, and seemingly dead-obvious things, such as the issuance of steel helmets for the boys in the trenches. Winston would excel at this post until the Great War came to its conclusion. Between wars, Churchill called for the nationalisation of railways, a control on monopolies, tax reform, and the creation of a League of Nations to prevent further conflict. When Lloyd George wins election, he puts Winston back into the War Office as Secretary of State for War and Air, where he finds himself responsible for the demobilisation of the British Army still deployed at the Rhine. And it's worth noting that he is one of the very few government figures opposed to the uber-harsh, punitive measures to be clamped down on the German neck in defeat, although that is at least in part because he divined a need for a bulwark against the newly minted Soviet Russia, who had a distinct distaste for monarchical kingdoms such as England, who did not back their rise in the gory Russian Civil War. Churchill bloody hated communism and took every opportunity to slam Lenin. He would later say, quote, "I will not pretend that, if I had to choose between communism and Nazism, I would choose communism." During the Irish War for Independence, Winston unleashed the British Army, aka the Black and Tans, who would become infamous for their thuggish and utterly callous brutality against the Hibernians, and sent them to the Emerald Island to put an end to Irish republicanism. Later, as Secretary of State for the Colonies, Winston would negotiate with Sinn Féin leaders and help draft the Anglo-Irish Treaty that brought an end to the war, although that would prove to be far from the end of conflict in that region. In the Middle East, when British troops clashed with Kurdish rebels, Winston called for the use of poison gas to be used to, quote, "inflict punishment on recalcitrant natives without inflicting grave injury upon them." Now, Winston, perhaps rightfully, gets a lot of flack for this stance. The use of the phrase "uncivilized natives" aside, which was less a racial epithet since British military doctrine simply called any stateless opponent an uncivilized tribe, but let's take a moment to look at what Winston actually said. Quote, "I do not understand the squeamishness about the use of gas. We have definitely adopted the position at the peace conference of arguing in favor of the retention of gas as a permanent method of warfare. It is sheer affectation to lacerate a man with the poisonous fragment of a bursting shell and to boggle at making his eyes water by means of lacrimatory gas. I am strongly in favor of using poisoned gas against uncivilized tribes. The morale effect should be so good that the loss of life should be reduced to a minimum. It is not necessary to use the most deadly of gases. Gases can be used which can cause great inconvenience and would spread a lively terror, and yet would leave no serious permanent effects on most of those affected." What Winston is talking about is tear gas. That's what lacrimatory means, tear-inducing. the same exact thing currently in use by America's police forces against its own citizens to combat riots. He held the same argument in lobbying for its use in India, saying, quote, "Gas is a more merciful weapon than the high explosive shell and compels an enemy to accept a decision with less loss of life than any other agency of war. If it is fair for an Afghan to shoot down a British soldier behind a rock and cut him to pieces where he lies wounded on the ground, why is it not fair for a British artilleryman to fire a shell which makes the said native sneeze? It really is too silly." Now, okay, the sneezing line is a bit of an understatement, but I think that his thesis is that he'd rather kill less people. Simple as that. If technology can achieve this, then why not? But let's also remember why the fighting was happening at all. These Kurds were rebelling against British rule because of arbitrary territorial lines that had been drawn across their traditional homeland. All this less lethal lobbying was in service of British imperialism, plain and simple. And again, if one tries to chalk this up to the old, "Well, didn't everyone think this way at the time?" let it be known that Winston had very clearly set his flag at the hardest end of the British imperialist spectrum, as well noted by his colleagues and elected peers at the time. Winston was also a fierce defender of Jewish Zionism, which, wholly backed by the British military at this stage, was being kicked into absolute overdrive. Churchill said of the Jews, quote, "We owe to the Jews a system of ethics which, even if it were entirely separate from the supernatural, would be incomparably the most precious possession of mankind, worth, in fact, the fruits of all wisdom and learning put together." Even so, he did chide the Israelis for what he deemed ingratitude for their very existence, lamenting that they, quote, "take it for granted that the local population will be cleared out to suit their convenience." And speaking of that local population, Churchill described the Arabs as, quote, "a lower manifestation than the Jews, whom he treated as, quote, a higher grade race, compared to the, quote, great hordes of Islam." He also referred to Palestinians as, quote, "barbarians who ate little but camel dung." Churchill also absolutely and unequivocally hated Mahatma Gandhi. When Gandhi launched his campaign of peaceful anti-colonial resistance, Churchill raged that he, quote, "ought to be lain bound hand and foot at the gates of Delhi, and then trampled on by an enormous elephant with the new viceroy seated on his back." Later on, when resistance against the British Raj swelled, Churchill announced, quote, "I hate Indians. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion." Churchill's hateful obsession with Gandhi, in fact, sent ripples through the politics of the time, as well as tinged the perception of Winston's hyperbolic nature. People sometimes question, why on earth didn't people listen to Churchill's warnings about Hitler in the late 1930s? To which the short answer is that he'd used the exact same language about Gandhi in the early 30s. When Gandhi began his famous hunger strike, Churchill refused to believe that he was not sneaking glucose with his meals, and tried to both undermine his self-suffering as well as paint him as an agent of the Axis powers, saying, quote, "we should be rid of a bad man and an enemy of the empire if he died." As with many who subscribe to the then-prevailing notion of the white man's burden, Winston believed that British imperialism was for the good of the, quote, "primitive and subject races," stating that, by conquering and dominating other peoples, the British were also elevating and protecting them. To put an even finer point on the racial aspect of his feelings, during an interview as far back as 1902, while discussing his views on the Chinese, Churchill plainly said that, quote, "great barbaric nations would menace the civilized nations, but the Aryan stock is bound to triumph." A good illustration of this kind of cocksure, haughty style that Winston wielded in power is evidenced in his bragging about his role in the British Mandate of Transjordan. On multiple occasions, while sipping brandy and spinning yarns, Winston liked to say, quote, "with a stroke of a pen on one Sunday afternoon in Cairo, I created the Kingdom of Jordan." In 1921, in that post-Great War carving up of the Middle East, which he was indeed overseeing, after a particularly liquid lunch, the then-colonial secretary's penmanship was quite wobbly, which, when applied to the map, produced a wildly erratic borderline. The resulting absurdly sharp zigzag that delineates the border between Jordan and Saudi Arabia is now known to history as Winston's Hiccup or the Churchill Sneeze. Now, whether this is simply legend or just Winston, always the showman, flexing to impress foreign dignitaries, the fact that he did brag about this kind of reckless, flippant wielding of power, with absolutely zero thought of the impact on the various tribes and peoples who now had a border arbitrarily carved through their traditional homeland, reveals the striking way in which Winston regarded these peoples as lesser. Since much of the horrible shit in this period can be traced back to imperialism, as Secretary of State of the Colonies, it is crystal clear that Winston was an avowed, unapologetic, and uncompromising wielder of the British imperialist sword, and with no small amount of self-righteous glee. It is often asked, was Winston Churchill a racist? Well, allow me to include this final quote from his speech to the Palestinian Royal Commission in 1937. Quote, "I do not admit for an instant that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." It is simply impossible to understand Churchill without examining his stance on race, and rather more so his belief that the strongest race will, and should, dominate. And this is not unfairly putting a 19th century hero to 20th century standards, but simply stating the facts. This is not controversy, but merely history. Speaking of racists, in 1932, while on tour of his ancestors' battlefields, Winston ends up in Munich, where he bends the elbow with Ernst Haufstengel, a confidant of Hitler, who was then rising in prominence. Talking to Haufstengel, Churchill raised concerns about Hitler's anti-Semitism and, probably only because of that, missed the opportunity to meet his future nemesis. But God, that would have been one hell of a picture, no? Winnie, all gut and jowls, cigar clamped in his maw, blood alcohol level higher than a Munich bell tower. Hitler, his little mustache quivering in utter disgust, a stalk of celery clenched angrily between his ass cheeks. Would have been one hell of a scene. Anyway, now the fun begins. Churchill had always seen himself as a man of destiny. His self-belief manifested proudly in his, quote, affinity with war. Well, destiny was now about to pay old Winston a call. Hitler grabs power in 33 and Churchill sounds the alarm, calling him a menace to civilization, further warning that proposed reductions in British Air Force spending would see Germany outmatching them in the air war, which he was convinced was imminent. In light of Chamberlain's appeasement posture to Mussolini, a policy which he was now extending to Hitler, Winston becomes the loudest anti-appeasement voice in the nation. He pushes for a mutual defense pact among European states, urging Chamberlain to threaten Hitler with a war declaration if he invades Czechoslovakia. But Chamberlain pussies out and signs the Munich Agreement, which hands over the Sudetenland to Germany. Winston calls this, quote, a total and unmitigated defeat. Britain finally declares war on September 3rd, and Chamberlain appoints Churchill back to his old post as First Lord of the Admiralty. The heartening message, Winston's back, bounces from ship to ship across the anxious fleet as they prepare for round two. When the Allies fail to prevent the invasion of Norway, Chamberlain faces a vote of no confidence. With Churchill being part of his war cabinet, despite loathing every step on the path Chamberlain has put them on thus far, Churchill must actually defend the government that he is a part of. That same day, the Germans take Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, putting the glittering prize of France in Nazi gun sights. With the real shitstorm brewing, The government refuses to serve under the feckless Chamberlain, and the king is told to call for Winnie. Declaring every success and failure up to this point being, quote, a preparation for this hour and for this trial, Mr. Churchill takes the helm as Britain's Prime Minister. As Europe's future balances on the knife's edge, and with certain government fuckwits still pushing for a negotiated peace settlement, Churchill grabs the reins. Though it is amusing now to look back and think that a deal might have actually been done with Hitler, Churchill wholeheartedly announces his immovable position of fuck that shit, and employs his fantastic oratory gifts to harden public opinion against a peaceful resolution and prepares the British people for another long and bloody war with the Jerrys.
I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
Deploying phrases that have proven to reverberate through the ages, Winston meets the moment with his very first speech as Prime Minister.
You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. But without victory there is no survival.
What Winston did here was rally the nation in the face of certain attack from a brutal juggernaut. In 6 major speeches given over the next 4 months, Churchill defines the pugnacity, the stalwart resolution, the stiff upper lip, and that legendary fighting spirit that has come to define Britain and the greatest generation that was forced to face this crucible.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender!
That there was Sir Gary Oldman's Oscar-winning depiction of Winston in Darkest Hour. Well met, Gary. Well met. But the funny thing about that speech is, the one delivered to Parliament was indeed the rousing, thrilling moment of momentum and resolve that you just heard, but for technological reasons, being that the chamber was not set up for live recording, that's not the one that the public heard. Winnie would, later that evening, re-record the speech for broadcast, and that one got really shitty reviews. Unmemorable, his delivery nothing short of dismal, with some concerned citizens writing in to inquire as to whether their PM was drunk. To which those in the recording studio chalked up to Winnie's refusal to remove the damn cigar from his mouth. Although hardly the turning point moment in the mind of the public, viewed with historical hindsight, it would prove to be just that. One fun oratory detail is Winston's Nazi lisp. Winston did actually have a legit speech impediment, which is insane being that he made his mark on history first and foremost as a public speaker. Winston even managed to turn this impediment into a weapon, as when he decided to call Hitler a Nazi rather than a Nazi. He never really could pronounce Nazi with the TS, so instead changed it to Nazi, which rhymes with Kazi, which is what Scouse and Cockney Brits of the time had colourfully dubbed the shit room. You know, that little room with just a toilet and no sink, solely for offloading one's intestinal foulness? That's a Kazi. And, thanks to Winston, the pronunciation stuck. A cute and effective bit of potty humour from the old boy, that. Not just pretty words, Churchill had no illusions about the ugly battle that lie ahead. After his famous "We shall fight on the beaches" speech, Churchill whispered to a colleague, "And we'll fight them with the butt ends of broken beer bottles, because that's all we've bloody got." And what we must appreciate here are the stakes. This was not just another war with the Jerrys that would be fought over there, with no bullets or bombs scarring English soil. But when France fell so inconceivably easily to the Nazi blitzkrieg, which in fact in itself was bloody unfathomable to comprehend, let alone the fact that the Krauts kicked her doors down in just a matter of weeks. It meant the Luftwaffe had acquired a convenient launch pad from which to unleash their hellish Valkyries from, just a channel away on the newly conquered French coast. We are talking fear of an imminent invasion by a technologically superior and thoroughly modern war machine. British newspapers printed stories such as, "What to do if you see a panzer rolling down your street?" And this was neither in jest nor hyperbole. Gas masks hung from every bedpost, with a child-sized version adorning every crib. With the setting of the sun, so too was Britain plunged into nightly blackouts. Whole towns and cities cloaking themselves in inky darkness in the hopes of hiding from the hunting swarms of Luftwaffe Nightjägers, who held dominion over the starry night sky when the exclusively daytime-dwelling Spitfires and Hurricanes could not rise to meet them. The shrill, hellish sound of the Stuka's Jericho trumpet echoed through English dreams. The Nazis' newest nightmare weapon was a 13-foot-long Satan bomb packed with 4,000 pounds of explosives. These devils could easily incinerate an entire city block, and not just any city block, but yours. This was the new reality for Britain. With the Nazi squadrons using France as its lily pad, abstract worries about war became an all-consuming state of mind that invaded the psyche, turning every passing shadow into a Messerschmitt and every car backfire into the bark of a panzer. It is lit by the glow of London aflame that Churchill truly shines. He quickly ordered the formation of both the Special Operations Executive and the Commandos, effectively inventing the Black Ops clandestine behind enemy lines operators that we know today, telling them to get dirty, disregard gentlemanly warfare, and go now and set Europe ablaze. Winston completely re-energized the government with dynamic energy which hitherto was unimaginable. He takes full responsibility for the war and creates and kickstarts the Ministry of Aircraft Production, recognizing that the only way to defend their island would be from the air. Every day he relished fielding new ideas about weapons and tactics, no matter how wild or fantastic, including saturating the skies above London with floating mines. Anything at all to stick it to the Jerrys. Upon hearing the term sticky bomb, before the pitch was even over, he simply growled, "Make 1 million," and marched out of the room. Winston also took to carrying a pistol, which he apparently misplaced often, and using it as a flourish to make a point, would whip it out and brandish it, screaming, "They shall never take me alive!" with no shortage of deranged glee or seriousness. For this truly was no joke, as evidenced by the cyanide-capped pen, which never left his breast pocket. Adolf, on the other hand, considered the war already won. He was so convinced that he actually demobilized 1/5 of his army. He was absolutely sure that a peace deal was in the offing, and truly had no desire to destroy the greatest empire of the modern age, one that he admired greatly and openly, and perhaps even suffered a bit of an inferiority complex over. Reinforced by Göring and his generals, Hitler believed the Luftwaffe was an absolutely unbeatable weapon, one that Churchill would be a fool to force him to use in earnest, so much so that Hitler even deemed the greatest city in the world, London itself, strictly off-limits to air raids, and pressed Göring to vanquish their foes in air-to-air combat in the belief that claiming air supremacy would force Churchill to the negotiation table. And thus, The English skies became one vast azure battlefield as squadrons of knightly Spitfires dueled with the Messerschmitt-born Teutonic invaders in what would become known to history as the Battle of Britain. These daily skyborne battles slaughtered scores on both sides. Littering the countryside with the crashed wreckage of fallen warriors. Of this months-long dogfight that would decide the fate of the realm, Churchill described it thusly, quote, "What more glorious thing can a spirited young man experience than meeting his opponent at 400 miles an hour, with 12 or 1500 horsepower in his hands, and unlimited offensive power? It is surely the most splendid form of hunting one can imagine." And civilians were able to watch these heavenly jousts just by standing in their own gardens. Necks craned skyward, watching contrails intersect, the buzzing black silhouettes dancing in their mortal ballet. And you'd find breathless BBC announcers conducting live blow-by-blow coverage of these daily dogfights, like football announcers calling the World Cup.
"Now the British fighters are coming up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fighters fighting right over our heads now. There's one coming right down on the tail of what I think is the Messerschmitt. I think it's a bit far behind him. There's one coming down in flames. There's somebody in the German, and he's coming down a long streak. He's coming down completely out of control, a long streak of smoke. The man's bailed out by parachute. The man's bailed out by parachute. He's a Junkers 87, and he's going flap into the sea, and there he goes. Smash! Terrific crumble of water, and there was a Junkers 87. But I can't see the aeroplanes. There we go again. What? What? Yes, oh, we've just hit a Messerschmitt. Oh, that was beautiful. He's coming right down now. I think definitely that first contest. Yes, he's come down. He's come down. Here's the surprise. He's finished. Oh, he's coming down like a rocket now. Absolute steep dive. Trying to move around so I can squash him a bit more. Here he comes. Down in the steep dive. A Messerschmitt looking for the parachute, and it's... No, no, the pilot's not getting out of that one. Here they go.
Yes, they're being chased home, and how they're being chased home. There are three Spitfires chasing three Messerschmitts. Oh boy, look at them going. And look at the Messerschmitt. Hey, that is really grand. And there's a Spitfire just behind the first two. He'll get them. Oh yeah. Oh boy, I've never seen anything so good as this. The RAF fighters have really got these boys.
That was Charles Gardner doing a bit of battlefield play-by-play, observing from the cliffs of Dover in July 1940. And thrilling as it may sound, the losses were quickly adding up. In just a few short months, despite the gallantry of the RAF, most British airfields lie in ruin, their squadrons utterly bereft of aircraft, leaving Churchill's Ministry of Aircraft Production struggling mightily to replace them, a task which looked more and more grim with every downed defender, the noose of invasion constricting tighter and tighter around the throat of the cut-off island nation. Reports of Nazi paratroopers staging in Belgium stokes fear of an airborne attack. Churchill orders church bells silent, only to be rung in the event of invasion. Pressure to consider a peace deal mounts, the warming weather now providing perfect conditions for a channel crossing. Visions of one's hometown turned into a chlorine gas-choked Great War battlefield played out across the collective English imagination. The horrors of that first hell all too fresh in the minds of the veterans who had lived it firsthand. But Churchill would not flinch, which infuriated Hitler, who raged in red-faced fury, ordering his deft propaganda ministry to paint Churchill as the villain, the lone man whose futile vanity was responsible for England's suffering. To this, Winston could only chuckle, grinning at the fact that the war at this point had been boiled down to a feud between two iron-willed men. And then, by a twist of luck or fate, on the night of August 24th, 1940, a lost Luftwaffe bomber squadron broke Hitler's personally issued embargo and accidentally disgorged its bombload on the city of London. Completely unintentional and amounting to minor damage and just 9 Londoners killed, this little accident might today be fairly described as the night that Hitler lost the war. Although British industrial centers and airfields were the daily and nightly targets of devastatingly successful Luftwaffe raids, to hit London, especially when Hitler had publicly promised not to, well, this indeed was the slip that old Winnie was praying for. And he wasted no time, ordering a revenge attack on Berlin, which would be the first bombing raid on the Nazi capital in the war. Much like the Doolittle raid to come, it was mostly symbolic and caused little damage, but the rage that it inspired in Hitler was volcanic. Made even more stinging in light of the fact that just weeks before, Göring had promised Hitler and the German public that it was literally impossible for Allied bombers to ever penetrate that far into German territory. Think again, Göring, you Zeppelin-shaped twat. And in so doing, Churchill goaded little Adolf into a series of reprisals that would change the dynamic of the war. The long simmering kettle was now about to finally reach its hellish crescendo. On a gorgeous sapphire August day, the still and stifling 90-degree heat chased Londoners to Hyde Park in search of a breeze as they sunbathed by the Serpentine. It was just about tea time when ears perked to a low thrum issuing from the south. As eyes looked to the sky, pupils dilated as they made out an incoming constellation of matte black intruders. The thrum changing gear to a deafening roar, met with shrieks of terror and crashing china as civilians fled for cover. The sky above London was soon full of 1,000 Nazi aircrafts, the first of 3 waves, which arrived completely unmolested by Royal Air Force interceptors, who were at this moment still circling over the airfields that had, up to now, been the target of such raids. By the time they realized the massive swarm clouding their radar was headed for London, it was too late. As were the air raid sirens, which only now sounded as if an afterthought. As the shadowy silhouettes of Dorniers, Junkers, and Henkels inked over the city streets, the shrill whistle and crash of falling Flammenbomben erupted in molar-rattling geysers of fire and debris. Row houses and whole city blocks were pulverized into rising plumes of destruction that enshrouded the city in an all-encompassing gray layer comprised of the dust of ages. From Cromwell to Dickens to Victoria, which had up to now lain undisturbed for generations. Nazi pilots could feel the shockwaves of their deliveries detonating below, especially that of those 4,000-pound Satan bombs, which shrieked in their death dive like an ungodly train whistle, and crashed in a sickening thunderclap that reverberated through the earth, vaporizing entire apartment blocks in its indiscriminate destruction. night, as the sky glowed orange from the burning city, Churchill drove past heaps of rubble that had been homes just hours ago. The sight of paper Union Jacks sticking out of the smoldering ruins bringing a lump to his throat. Making his way into the shattered East End, where firemen and rescue crews worked feverishly to pull the living and the dead from the ruins, he came upon an air raid shelter, where a crowd had formed around some 40 recovered corpses. As his shoes crunched shattered glass upon his approach, Churchill could not be sure as to what kind of greeting he might get. And it's a moment like this that I believe truly reveals the make of this man. Just an old man, alone, leaning on his walking stick with tears in his eyes, his only accompaniment waiting in the car, despite being the most important figure in the country. As he approaches the singed citizens whom his words and actions had delivered to this most ghastly moment, one must wonder, would they hate him? Would they blame him for failing to protect them as they stood amid the charred timber that was once their homes? Upon catching sight of his unmistakable silhouette, a member of the crowd shouts, "Good old Winnie, we thought you'd come and see us. We can take it, so long as you give it 'em back." Seeing Winston wiping tears from his eyes, an old woman shouts, "See, he's crying. He really cares." Another woman, covered in the dust of what was once her home, shouts, "When are we going to bomb 'em back, Winnie?" To which Churchill spins, grips up his walking stick and snarls, "You leave that to me." His tearful eyes glinting with firelight as he meets the gaze of each member of that crowd, exuding a kind of invincibility that was indeed infectious. The effect of this moment was to immediately redouble the resolve of the crowd, putting on display Churchill's unique ability to take a hopeless and despondent situation and turn it into a grimly certain stepping stone towards ultimate victory. Churchill would continue touring the destruction, refusing to head for safety, even as the blazing buildings provided targets for the next wave of attack. And the bombs did fall. With Winston's driver skidding around craters and just dodging the crashing hiss and heat flash of German incendiary Flammenbomben, as they erupted just yards ahead. And this little tale that might seem like legend was in fact just the way that Winston reacted when the storm settled overhead. At the shriek of sirens, he would ascend to the rooftop to watch his city be subjected to a nightly 9/11 with his very own eyes. In addressing his family, he insisted that each one of them should take one Nazi down with them in the event of an assault on the city, rather than be taken alive. When his daughter-in-law protested, saying, quote, "But I don't even know how to fire a gun," his reply was, "Then you must run to the kitchen and find a carving knife." Nobody present took this as a joke, not even for an instant. Goring had promised the destruction of London in 4 days. Yet, after 4 weeks of non-stop bombing, even as they were down to the last 100 fighters, Winston and England's resolve proved unwavering, causing Hitler to bristle and kick his air attacks into overdrive, unleashing the full might of the Blitz on civilian targets across the island, aiming to immolate the British will to resist. London suffered 57 consecutive nights of hellish raids, with places like Coventry literally burned off the map in one fateful night. Winston managed to spin this grotesque targeting of civilians as a way to harden public resolve and foment blazing white-hot hatred for their enemy. He held up the banner of "London Can Take It," touring bombed-out towns and cathedrals, making sure that pictures and newsreels of the destruction spread across the world. And through the worst of it, it was made clear that, to borrow a phrase, if you're going through hell, keep going. And with unwavering Winston at the helm, despite the grim day-to-day death and destruction, that's exactly what Britain did. Making good on his efforts to recognize sacrifices he had wished for those who had bled for the realm in the First World War, Churchill made heroes out of every heroic deed, both large and small, from civilian to elite units, especially during the bleakest of days. He forever lionized the Royal Air Force for their fantastic underdog defense of the air above their beloved island, thanking, quote, "the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed to so many by so few. Words that shall ring eternal through the halls of Valhalla for all time." And all the while, at every possible chance, he was lobbying, begging, and pleading for American support. He knew that it was their key to salvation, and he was largely successful. And not only in edging American sentiment towards sympathy for their beset ally, it was chiefly his good relationships with Franklin Delano Roosevelt that secured vital food, oil, and munitions, despite America's overall unwillingness to break neutrality. Winston's efforts persuading FDR to persuade Congress to accept the Lend-Lease deal, which allowed lease of countless strategically vital U.S. military bases, and repayment for this immensely costly aid to take the form of essentially defending the U.S. by defending the U.K., allowed hardware, everything from tinned beef to mortar rounds to frigates and Sherman tanks, all to be, quote, "used until returned or destroyed." This vital lifeline to a besieged island whose irreplaceable resources were rapidly dwindling is in fact what kept Britain alive through the darkest days of the war. 7/12/1941. Japan commits one of the all-time greatest and most egregious fuck-ups in military history with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You really should not have fucked with America's boats. Upon learning this blessed news, Winston said he was, quote, "saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation. I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and thankful." Saturated and satiated Winnie. My, that's a sticky vision indeed. Something like Pooh Bear using a honeypot as a grotesque fructose-rich fleshlight. Ah! With the States and the Brits now in the same cookpot, he knew there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And despite the attack on the U.S. coming from the far, far east, Churchill immediately fought his damnedest and successfully won over his new allies in a Europe-first attack strategy. But yet, 'tis true it's always darkest before the dawn. Amid those cataclysmic, failure-studded early days, including the fall of Singapore, Rangoon, Burma, and Tobruk, and the successful German Channel Dash, which took a steaming sauerkraut shit on British naval prestige, with Hitler and Hirohito charging an untamed advance on all fronts, Winnie spanned the globe from battlefield to battlefield, endeavoring to raise troop morale and inspire resilience, flying to Moscow to solidify his alliance with Stalin, and to Washington to deep-throat Roosevelt and secure shipments of tanks and howitzers. And to manage all this dangerous travel, Winston had built what he called his life pod, a pressurized chamber which included a phone, an ashtray, and an air circulation system so that he could continuously and uninterruptedly smoke for his health. His long flights were often supplemented with the soon-famous Churchill Martini, which consisted of a glass of chilled English gin supplemented with a nod towards France, as vermouth was understandably difficult to source at the current moment. When travelling by ship, he always had a lifeboat mounted with a machine gun so that he could, quote, "resist capture at all costs." Old Winnie, the jowly British bulldog, seen gripping a Tommy gun in North Africa, or flashing the two-fingered fuck you V, became an omnipresent human morale booster, and the very embodiment of his country's dogged, unrelenting fighting spirit. Then finally, after so much death, horror, and destruction, the worm finally began to turn. With the recapture of Stalingrad and victory at El Alamein, Churchill ordered the church bells, which were only to be rung to herald a German invasion, to sound throughout Great Britain for the first time since early 1940, telling his countrymen that, quote, "This is not the end. This is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning." But it's never all just sunshine and rainbows, is it? Perhaps most notoriously, at the same time, Churchill presided over the hideous 1943 famine in Bengal, where some 3 million Indians perished. Despite the urgent need for resources, Churchill demanded the exportation of rice and other staple foods to fuel the British war effort. Upon his orders, stockpiles bypassed starving India and were diverted to feed European civilians once they had been liberated. That means those supplies were not even reallocated for imminent need, but rather put in storage for a future one. Often citing the fog of war, Churchill was indeed completely focused on the battle for Europe, and thus proved himself utterly indifferent to the Indian plight, allegedly saying of the millions suffering that the famine was their own fault for breeding like rabbits. He would later refer to the ghastly result as a merry culling of the population. Through British reign, he and other imperial rulers worked to create sectarian fissures within India's independence movement, which led to the brutal partition of India when it finally won its freedom in 1947. And it must be noted that India was far from the only corner of the British Empire victim to such divide-and-rule tactics. Churchill's own Secretary of State for India would liken his boss's callousness to India's plight to that of King George III's apathy for the Americans. While this country-scarring event was playing out, Churchill was obsessively involved in the planning of Operation Overlord and the long-awaited liberation of Europe. With the great battle looming, Churchill even made arrangements to cross the Channel the day after the initial invasion. But to his consternation, Winston was deemed too vital, and his plans were vetoed by the King. Apparently furious, he was forced to wait until D plus 12 to wade ashore. As the death toll of the horrific war reached its bloody crescendo, Churchill would again find himself at the center of controversy when his area bombing strategy incinerated Dresden, which at the time was bloated with civilians, wounded, and refugees fleeing the carnage of the East. The Brits and the Yanks lit up the ancient German city, pouring almost 5,000 tons of high-explosive and incendiary bombs onto that once magnificent cosmopolitan, creating a literal hurricane of fire whose temperatures rose to almost 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, consuming all organic matter in its holocaust, leaving nothing much to count by way of casualties. Although the overall number killed on that horrific day has swung wildly over the years and remains disputed to this day, no one disputes the fact that it was a tragedy. Although Winston had previously been recorded during the planning stage of the bombing strategy as saying, quote, "I do not want suggestions as to how we can disable the German economy and her machinery of war. What I want are suggestions as to how we can roast the German refugees on their escape from Breslau." And in 1942, quote, "All the industrial centers should be attacked in intense fashion, with every effort being made to terrorize the population." In light of the excessive civilian casualties, Winston did in fact decide to curb the bombing strategy, saying after Dresden, quote, "I feel the need for more precise concentration upon military objectives rather than on mere acts of terror and wanton destruction, however impressive. Though the targeting of Dresden has been dubbed everything from a war-shortening way to finally break German morale, all the way to Churchill's own brand of cold-blooded revenge, especially in light of the liberation of Auschwitz just 1 week before, I'm not so sure it's fair to call it any of those things. At the time, if anything, Dresden was just another city in the way of the Russian advance. A city which suffered the same horrific fate as Tokyo, Osaka, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. Such is the inevitable evil of total war. In the backstretch of the great fight, Winston did lots of things, most importantly of which were his meetings of the Big Three, where he, FDR, and Stalin shaped the post-war peace and attempted to engineer some kind of self-determination to the liberated peoples of post-Nazi Europe. These meetings, in essence, divvied up the world as we know it and set the stage for the Cold War to come, including the creation of what Churchill would later famously dub the Iron Curtain. That, and a whole mess of other things, and if you really want to go over all that, you are very free to grab any of the 100 bloody geopolitical books written about it and start digging, because I've got neither the time nor the inclination to begin that crusade here and now. Perhaps one day we shall dive into those innumerable specifics, but today is emphatically not that day. On May 8th, 1945, it was Churchill's voice that crackled through the airwaves and across the globe, announcing the final ceasefire on all fronts in light of Germany's unconditional surrender.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
That evening, Winston appeared on the balcony at Buckingham Palace, alongside the royal family, to meet an absolutely massive crowd of celebrating citizens. He then went to Whitehall, where he addressed another throng of overjoyed Britons, saying, quote,
"This is your victory, victory of the cause of freedom, is everywhere. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all."
Churchill then asked his wartime Labour minister to come forward and share in the applause, but to this he said, "No, Winston, this is your day," and proceeded to conduct the adoring crowd in the singing of "For He is a Jolly Good Fellow." But even after all that, Winston still lost the 1945 election. Whether it was an overwhelming desire for post-war reform or the idea that the man who led them into war was not the ideal man to lead them to peace, one thing was certain. British society had changed drastically during the war. Voters had become less class-bound, the evacuation of urban kids to rural areas, service of all classes in the armed forces, even the motley of citizens consistently sharing bomb shelters with strangers had facilitated social mixing on an entirely new scale, which in turn helped give way to a whole new political atmosphere. So despite huge personal support for Winnie across the country, with some seemingly wishing that he could remain Prime Minister regardless of what party took over, the Labour Party slogan, "Let us face the future," ultimately proved to be far more appealing than Churchill's already unpopular Conservative Party's plea to finish the job. Back in 1940, King George had been reluctant to appoint Churchill, sharing the establishment's open disdain for him. But over those six long wartime years, sharing the lows of defeat and the highs of victory, the king became understandably close with his prime minister, and was saddened by his defeat. In recognition of his peerless service and perhaps in consolation of his loss, George offered Winnie the Order of the Garter, the most senior knighthood and highest possible honor that the sovereign could bestow. But Churchill declined, noting ruefully that the British people had just given him the Order of the Boot. When asked his opinion about being the recipient of the greatest example of democratic ingratitude in history, Mr. Churchill took it in stride, at least on the surface, simply saying they should not be judged too harshly, as the British people have had a very hard time. Winston continued to lead the opposition party for the next 6 years. While touring the USA, he would give one of his most impactful speeches, his words defining the Cold War era, declaring that, quote, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent." He always did hate those bloody Soviets. During this time, he proposed and cultivated the special relationship between America and England, developing the incredibly close political, diplomatic, cultural, economic, and military relations that are still alive today. Then in 51, Winston's Conservative Party won the general election and Churchill again found himself Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. At 77 years old, the old boy's body was evidently breaking down, his alcohol consumption was up, and his napping in the parliamentary chamber was at an all-time high. And yet, he refused to step down, especially in light of King George's rather surprising death, seeing himself as the correct person to groom Queen Elizabeth as she ascended the throne, even taking in hand the Foreign Office when Anthony Eden became ill. In 1953, Churchill, now a prolific author of more than 33 books in 58 volumes, his blood-stirring speeches pressed into best-selling albums, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Literature, credited for his mastery of historical and biographical description, as well as for brilliant oratory in defending exalted human values. In this way, he made good on one of his most infamous quotes, "History shall be kind to me, as I propose to write it." Well, he supposedly said something like that. What he actually said is longer and a bit different, but you get the gist anyway. Now, at this point, it might have been best for Winston, and perhaps Britain, if he had taken the opportunity to step down, heaped with honors, and allowed the tide of time to wash him to the undying lands of victorious rest. But, of course, that was never his style. In fact, before the king's death, he had supposedly intended to ask Winston to stand down in light of his evident decline. It was also widely expected that Churchill would quit after the new queen's coronation. But instead, Winston would cling to power until his 81st year, suffering strokes and hiding them, and pushing for anachronistic imperialist policies aimed at reclaiming the past glory of a British empire that was quickly sinking into the sand beneath his feet. At his final cabinet meeting, before going to Buckingham Palace to tender his resignation to the Queen, Churchill advised his ministers to never be separate from the Americans. Even though privately, Churchill was no fan of Eisenhower's, and said of John Foster Dulles, his Secretary of State, that he's the only case of a bull I know who carries his china closet with him. And if you really want a spectacular account of Churchill's later years, dig into The Crown. John Lithgow, who despite being an American and standing more than a bloody foot and a half taller than the actual Winston, does a bang-up job of portraying the crotchety old beast, struggling to maintain his grip on power and consciousness, seething about the ineffectual Anthony Eden, and hissing over losing the rule of Egypt. There's no secret it's a damn good show, fiction disclaimer aside. Winston finally stood down in 1964. Having seen the end of the Korean War, a million houses built, the abolition of rationing, the end of austerity, and the beginning of a return to prosperity, Britain had become a nuclear power. No part of the British Empire had been liquidated. He managed a smooth transition between monarchs and was knighted by his new queen, and even proclaimed an honorary citizen of the United States by John F. Kennedy, all in the final years of his office. Apart from 1922 to 1924, Winston had been an elected member of Parliament since the year 1900. And if one thing is for certain, it is that he hated surrendering this post. His wife Clementine described it as her husband's first death, and for him, a death in life. Churchill celebrated his 90th birthday with oysters and 60,000 messages of congratulations, just 2 months before he would finally shuffle loose his mortal coil. The mighty toll of Big Ben rang its 9:45 chime, then fell silent in respect for the passing of one of Britain's most towering figures.
Fire!
Cannons thundered 90 shots. One for each year of Churchill's life, as he became the first civilian in the 20th century to receive a state funeral, an honor reserved only for kings and queens. A tight formation of RAF fighters roared over the heads of more than 1 million mourners who packed the London streets to watch his funeral procession of servicemen from over 20 military units, taking 4 majors of the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars just to carry Churchill's litany of medals, orders, and decorations. Queen Elizabeth herself even broke with monarchical tradition to attend a funeral for someone outside of the royal family. Winston would be that exception. Dignitaries from an unprecedented 112 countries, including 6 monarchs, 6 presidents, and 16 prime ministers, would also be in attendance, making his state funeral the largest in history at the time. Winston's death came just 1 year after leaving office on January the 24th, 1964. But his legacy shall undoubtedly live on for innumerable generations, as he is widely regarded the greatest Briton who ever lived. But as we study this man's irrefutably incredible life with modern eyes, it's more and more challenging just to simply call him a hero. There is no doubt in my mind that he is most definitely a hero. But there is also no doubt in my mind that Winston is not just that. For instance, George W. Bush left a bust of Churchill near his desk in the White House in an attempt to associate himself with the war leader's heroic stand against fascism. His successor, Barack Obama, had the statue returned promptly to Britain. And with just a little bit of study, it's really not hard to guess why. Obama's Kenyan grandfather, Hussein Onyango Obama, was imprisoned without trial for 2 years, where he and thousands more suffered torture, all under Churchill's watch, for resisting the empire during the Mau Mau uprising, which has now been revealed to be a late British colonial tragedy rife with human rights abuses. Go ahead and put that in the old Google machine and see what you get. In this day and age, Churchill now takes his place among other similar chimeric figures, such as Thomas Jefferson, who, despite their greatest achievements and undeniable contributions to the free people of planet Earth, have ugly elements to their story that should not be glossed over and ignored, but met head-on with honest and critical study. Now, it's not my bloody place to say that Winston Churchill must be remembered solely for the Darwinian racial lens through which he viewed the world, nor Teddy Roosevelt be cancelled for his callous racial hate of the Native Americans. Nor is it my job to say that imperialism, which laid the blood-soaked bricks that built the British Empire, or America's genocidal manifest destiny, is as inherently horrific as Nazism. What I am saying is that you really can't claim to understand any of these figures or historical moments without taking into account all angles, regardless of how bitter or sweet. In speaking of his own death and judgment thereafter, Winston seemed quite accepting of the role he played on this earth, saying, quote, "I am prepared to meet my Maker. Whether my Maker is prepared for the great ordeal of meeting me is another matter." One thing I can say for damn sure is that by refusing to appease Hitler and his Reich, Winston committed himself to a battle against a globe-threatening evil, and in so doing, shaped the arc of human history. What would Britain be today without Winston Churchill? What would the world be like today without Winston Churchill? The fact that these are legitimate questions to ask illustrates the sheer power that Winston exerted on the world we know today. Perhaps Uncle Joe Stalin put it best when he said of Winston, quote, "There have been few cases in history where the courage of one man has been so important to the future of the world." So to this man, whose immense character inspired England to rise and meet its most ferocious challenge, I raise my glass. To a man who never dodged a fight, who never quit, no matter the odds. To a master of wit and words, to a born leader who inspired hope and stood up to evil. Sir Winston Churchill, cheers to you. Wishing you a blessed Churchill Day from the War Daddy Podcast. Cheers till next time.